This is an ABC podcast.
There are masses of small country towns across Australia on the highway that rely on the people passing through to make a living. In these towns, businesses are calling on politicians for a timeline for the road to economic recovery.
I think in our own state it would be good to get people moving around and so we don't fester all these other problems that could manifest, like the mental issues and all that sort of things,
And professional drivers race the iconic Mount Panorama track in Bathurst from the comfort of their living rooms.
I guess we're lucky in our sport. We get to still compete, you know. If you're playing rugby or cricket, you can't really play a game of that. You're just bashing buttons on a controller. Whereas for us, we still can replicate it with a steering wheel and pedals and sit in a proper seat and stuff.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide. In news today, an announcement from Federal Energy Minister Angus Taylor, who says the federal government is going to take advantage of cheap oil prices and buy up strategic oil reserves and store it in the United States. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
This is a unique opportunity to begin building a fuel reserve because we are seeing historically low prices. This is enormously important. Now is the time to move, and we are moving.
Samantha Hepburn is the director of the Centre for Energy and Natural Resources Law at Deakin University. Samantha Hepburn, is this a unique opportunity in your opinion?
It is a unique opportunity. Obviously, prices are at an all-time low and the oversupply generated by the COVID-19 pandemic has meant that it's a very good time to buy. The big question is whether it's a very good time to be storing our reserves in the United States, given the susceptibilities that are obviously apparent in international supply chains, and we've witnessed that from COVID-19. So I think that the real concern we have is how much is it costing us to store this cheap oil in the United States, and why don't we simply ship it over to Australian soils and develop our own reserves?
Have you any answers to those questions? Why would we buy this cheap oil and store it in the US if it is in fact strategic?
Well, I suspect that this is the outcome of the agreement that we signed on March the 10th, just prior to really the full impact of the pandemic. We signed a memorandum of agreement and the belief was that we would become compliant with our 90-day International Energy Agency mandate by buying up quickly reserves from the vast supply that the United States has, and that that would quickly give us the energy security we needed. But, this decision follows on from that agreement. But what's happened in the interim is that we've had the COVID-19 pandemic, and then we've had an oversupply of oil and historically low prices. So it now may be, with the benefit of hindsight, far more beneficial for Australia to buy the oil and develop our own storage and refinery capacity back here, because it means that we can become more self-reliant.
Is this a political decision rather than a strategic one?
Look, I think that, given that we don't actually know what the cost of this is, it probably is. I mean, ultimately, we've got to think about what's the best interest of Australian society. I mean, if there was any sort of disruption in international transit, we wouldn't be able to get our stockpile reserves that are supposed to be used for a crisis over to Australian soil. And that would be devastating. So we wouldn't want that to happen. We've already seen all the sorts of chaos that can occur when, there were supply problems during COVID-19. Can you imagine what would be the outcome if we ran out of liquid fuel? And we know we've only got on our shores 22 days of petrol and 21 days of diesel. So while we might technically be compliant with our obligations as a member of the International Energy Agency by buying up reserves from the United States, that doesn't necessarily deal with our domestic security concerns that have really escalated post-COVID, because now not only do we have concerns about international transit being impacted by geopolitical tensions, an oil strike, terrorism, problems in the Strait of Hormuz. We now have potentially the global pandemic concern. So what we know is that this sort of policy is inherently susceptible to risk, and we don't want risk when we're dealing with such a vital resource like liquid fuel.
If I understand it rightly, one of the reasons that West Texas crude oil dropped off so significantly and so quickly was a problem in storage. So now Australia is paying to store oil, which is exactly the problem that's created this low price.
Exactly. That's right. There is a certain irony in that. And, you know, I suppose why, you know, the question is, is it possible for us to get out of this agreement? Would it be preferable for us to take this oil? Storage is the problem. And then, you know, develop a more effective security framework by progressing our refineries. And, you know, we know that one of the reasons we're non-compliant with the International Energy Mandate is because our refineries have gradually closed down. So we've been relying on the mega refinery in Singapore to deliver us our liquid fuel because it's more cost effective and we can't compete with foreign refineries. But really, that's effectively meant that we don't have a stockpile. So what we actually want is to get our stockpile on our shores in the most cost effective manner. And we want to do that as quickly as possible, because who knows how long this particular pricing will continue for.
Do you expect there to be pushback against this decision?
Well, I expect that there needs... We need to press for more detail. What cost is this going to be? And why are we going down this line rather than developing our own, you know, locally based strategic reserves? And what's the benefit? And, you know, previously it was a cost benefit because it was going to be $6.8 billion or something to become compliant with the IEA mandate. Now, you know, a lot of that needs to be reevaluated.
It's fascinating, really. It's Samantha Hepburn, the Director of the Centre for Energy and Natural Resources Law at Deakin University. Thanks a million for chatting to Australia Wide.
Absolute pleasure.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. Across Australia, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of small country towns situated on the main highway that rely on the people passing through to make a living. Now, with people not moving around, there's no hum of traffic, but there's also no one doing any business. Williams in the Western Australian Wheatbelt is one such country town. It's been hit hard by regional border travel restrictions, and retail, hospitality and fuel business owners are now asking when the highway traffic they depend on will be allowed to flow again. Locals are calling on the Premier to give them a timeline for recovery as Western Australia continues to record fewer cases of COVID-19. Mark Bennett has this story.
I'm travelling on Albany Highway, the major arterial that connects Perth to towns to the southeast of the state. It extends 400 kilometres right down to the south coast, normally carries up to 4,000 cars a day. Today, it's practically empty, with just a handful of trucks and a few farm utes on the road. The Albany Highway runs through Williams, population 600, 2 hours south of Perth. And since the intrastate borders were shut in the lead up to Easter, the highway and the town that depends upon it is deadly quiet. Fuel station forecourts are empty, cafes are closed, the town looks deserted.
We're a service town. This town is a service town, so we service the travellers. That's what we do.
Since March 23rd, Williams Roadhouse owner Dave Phelps has seen his fuel and food business slashed by 80%. He's been forced to shut his other roadhouse in town, stand down workers, and drastically cut back opening hours. Now the COVID infection curve is starting to flatten. He and other business owners in town are asking, how long will it be before the borders are reopened?
I would say if we can go another week or two in WA without any more cases or spreading to the regions. I think it's definitely time to open the regions up and get a little bit of something moving.
More than 10% of people in Williams work in food, retail and fuel businesses, serving the passing traffic for their income.
Transport industry and farming is going absolutely crazy, and then your retail, your shops have gone backward. It's a shame to see it. The businesses in town have been steaming along, and then all of a sudden you get hit like this.
Shire President Jared Loki says the town is far from on its knees, but the travel restrictions have been a body blow.
It turns the town on its head pretty much, being on the main highway, amount of traffic, 4,000 cars a day or whatever we average. Yeah, it's a big stop.
He says the town agrees that Premier Mark McGowan's strict measures to contain the spread have worked.
He's actually pulled the coronavirus up quite well from actually spreading into the littler country of towns. But we'd really like to get back on board and start opening those boundaries as soon as we can to start pushing those businesses to get back to where they were.
We're very leveraged to the Albany Highway. It's the lifeblood of a lot of businesses here in town.
Simon Mailer has mothballed his wool clothing shop and cafe restaurant since the highway went quiet, standing down nearly all his staff. He wants to know what the next move by the government might be and when.
I just think probably some more leadership around what the road out looks like. From a business owner to understand what restrictions are going to be loosened, when they're going to be loosened, how they would be loosened, I think is vital.
David Phelps again.
I can understand keeping the hard border at the east-west interstate borders. But I think in our own state it would be good to get people moving around, and so we don't fester all these other problems that could manifest, like the mental issues and all that sort of things. You know, it's better to be alive and a little bit mental than dead with COVID, isn't it?
Mark Bennett with that story from Williams in the Western Australian Wheatbelt.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
As coronavirus restrictions hit sports teams hard, there are a few unexpected winners from the downturn. Professional drivers are racing the iconic Mount Panorama track in Bathurst later today from the comfort in their living rooms. The Supercars Championships is turning to virtual racing to keep the competition going. Esports, or competitive gaming, is seeing an explosion in audience numbers, and experts say it's just the beginning. Angelique Liu has more from Orange in central western New South Wales.
And we go racing supercars virtually for the very first time at Silverstone in the UK. And from the pole position, a great start by Di Pasquale, trouble at the back of the pack.
It may sound like an ordinary start to a race, but last week, 26 drivers in the Australian Supercars Championship took to the famous Silverstone track in the UK from their living rooms. As rugby league authorities negotiate border and travel restrictions within Australia and New Zealand, the Supercars has managed to transition online. The sport is running a 10-round competition to keep fans interested during coronavirus restrictions. Shane van Gisbergen is a driver for Holden Red Bull Racing, and he says they're better equipped than most to survive the downturn.
I guess we're lucky in our sport. We get to still compete. You know, if you're playing rugby or cricket, you can't really play a game of that. You're just bashing buttons on a controller. Whereas for us, we still can replicate it with a steering wheel and pedals and sit in a proper seat and stuff.
The Australian Supercars E-Series is drawing interest from around the world after Formula One driver Max Verstappen joined last week's round, taking out second place. It comes during a wider interest in esports, or competitive online gaming, driven in part by coronavirus restrictions on movements. And it's not just sports games. Viewers are tuning into competitions and tournaments for first-person shooters, arena battles, and even chess-like strategy games. Darren Kwan is the president of the Australian Esports Association, and he says there are about 1.5 million fans in Australia alone, and it's growing.
Inquiries to participate in the high school league went up about 150%, and participation in terms of viewership in the university league went up by about 20%. Now, that's grassroots. Some of the professional leagues we've seen around the space have gone up in viewership from, you know, somewhere like 3,000%.
Kwan says competitive gaming is becoming more lucrative.
At the top end right now, even in Australia, there's a lot of players who are currently salaried. So their day-to-day expenses are covered by, you know, a weekly stipend, and then there's endorsements, and then there's all these kinds of passive income that those players can be earning. And it can really vary from, you know, say a salary of something humble, like the average salary per year, all the way up into the hundreds of thousands.
Brody Kostecki is an up-and-coming driver for Eggleston Motorsports and is set to take to the Bathurst Mount Panorama track virtually later today. He's been driving go-karts since the age of four and, like many 23-year-olds, also grew up playing Xbox and computers. He also has a strong following on Twitch, and if you don't know what that is, imagine a YouTube for gaming fans.
Started racing both at the same sort of age, so you know, my passion for racing is just that high that you know, when I wasn't racing in real life, I wanted to, you know, race something. So that was the closest form of racing that I could come to.
He says it's helped his real life career.
In racing, experience is worth so much, and you know, you can learn new tracks without going there, so you know, you can save money in that aspect, and it sort of just sharpens your mind up a little bit.
Darren Kwan says car manufacturers are beginning to look at talent from sim races, with Nissan recruiting gamers to train in real-life cars.
When they come to the track, you see people like Nissan sort of saying, well, you've got some skills virtually. We can take that and train you into driving a real car.
But Kostecki says sim racing will never replicate the physicality of real driving.
It's hard to compare it to real life because you don't put your body through the emotions and, you know, the sort of stuff that you actually physically feel throughout the race car when you're driving it.
Van Gisbergen agrees and says it's no substitute for real-life driving.
On sim racing, you know, I get beaten by a lot of guys who are just normal people and people I've never heard of, you know, that can just get on and race. But certainly if they jumped in a real car, you know, maybe some of them would be good, but, you know, they'd really struggle with all the physical. And it's the fear of things, you know. In the racing last night, there's a few corners and a few passing moves that you'd consider or be a bit worried about the risk of it. But in a simulator, you just do it because there's no consequence of crashing, no consequence of hitting someone. So, you know, where in real life, those things really take over.
Van Gisbergen is currently coming third overall in the Supercars E-Series, so it looks like his job is safe for now.
Engineering. He steps it wide, he picks up the checkered flag, he grabs 75 points. He not only puts together a back-to-back victory, he is the round winner in Spain.
Angelique Liu with that story from Orange.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What
got
if
a...
it never come?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
Last week on Australia Wide, we told you about the decision by the Wagga Wagga City Council in New South Wales to end its 30-year-long sister relationship with the city of Kunming in China. The decision sparked a diplomatic spat between Australia and China. And at the time, the council said it wanted to cut its ties because of concerns over coronavirus and communism. Reaction to the decision by the regional city's plan was swift, and angry, both in Beijing and Canberra, and pressure was put on the council to review its decision. The council called an extraordinary general meeting tonight to reevaluate that decision, and Verity Gorman has been covering the story and joins us from Wagga Wagga. Now, Verity, I did sit in on some of the live stream of the meeting before we got on air, and there's definitely a wide range of opinions represented to the councillors. One of those they heard from was Dr. Lucy Zhao, who now lives in Wagga Wagga but was born in Australia. Let's have a listen to what she has to say before we have a chat.
The suffering of my family is just one example that is common among numerous families in China under the communist ruling. The current coronavirus disaster is another example how the Chinese government suppress different voices and cover up the true news at the cost of people's life and safety in China and around the world. So this coronavirus has woken up many Western governments to reassess their close ties with the Chinese government and reduce the risk of heavy reliance on Chinese supply. It's also a good time to reassess and discontinue the sister city connections.
That's Dr. Lucy Zhao, who was representing her point of view to the Wagga Wagga City Council today. Now, Verity, there was a number of locals born in China that made similarly passionate presentations. How did the councillors respond to that?
Yeah, there was a lot of debate at tonight's meeting about, you know, the different perspectives on this. And while I don't know if all of the people who spoke were actually from Wagga or living in Wagga, they just made representations as members of the public just about their experience of living in China and spoke about how their families have suffered under the communist regime. And the councillors thanked all of the speakers for sharing their stories, but then sort of went on to discuss how this motion that was put forward was really, it was about a people-to-people relationship between Kunming in China and Wagga Wagga. And councillors, in the end, they voted to rescind last week's motion, all but the original councillor who put forward the motion. So that sister city relationship will continue.
Did you hear from others outside of the councillors themselves that supported continuing the sister city relationship?
Yeah, well, there were three speakers who supported cutting ties, and one person who spoke about wanting the relationship to continue. And you know, there's been a lot of community support as well outside of tonight's meeting. We've heard from a lot of community leaders who've said, you know, Wagga is a multicultural city. We welcome sister city relationships because it gives people the chance to learn about a different culture and strengthen ties with China.
It was a spirited debate, that which I heard of it. Do you think it will get attention in China? Because prior to this, this whole situation has got attention in Chinese press.
Well, it has all over the world. This story, Wagga has been noted in international press for this decision. So it's not just in China, it's all over the world. But certainly it's attention that Wagga Council, it's not the kind of attention they've wanted. And people in Wagga feel quite disappointed that this is why their city has made the news. So certainly council will now issue an apology to its sister city Kunming, and it's hoping now that it'll be able to repair some of the damage that's been done to its reputation.
Is there a feeling that this damage is irreversible?
Well, no, I think they're, of course, always hopeful that they will be able to repair any damage that's been done. But during the meeting, councillors did acknowledge the fact that it will take time, and it'll take time to build up those relationships again that they had with their sister city, and and to be able to get the message out there that they want this to continue.
It seems a huge shift in gears in a very short amount of time. Why is that, Verity?
Well, it was quite unusual circumstances that led to the original motion passing, and the councillor who actually put forward the motion, Councillor Paul Fennell, he never actually expected it to be passed. He said he just wanted to raise his concerns about the Chinese government and communism and their handling of coronavirus. So the reason it passed, there's nine councillors, but only three voted last week to pass it, and two declared interest, so they weren't part of the vote, and the mayor was sick. So it was because of unusual circumstances that it passed in the first place. So now two councillors declared interest again, so they weren't part of the vote, but everyone else was there tonight, and the rescission motion passed, I think it was 6 votes for, 1 against.
And why do you think there was people allowed to represent themselves when they weren't part of the Wagga Wagga community, just quickly?
Well, it's open to any members of the public to put forward responses to this. So one of the grab you played from Dr. Zhao, she said she actually grew up in Kunming City, which was the sister city. So that sort of had particular relevance. So they're just talking and sharing their personal experience of life in China.
It's been a very interesting week in Wagga Wagga. Thanks very much, Verity Gorman.
Thanks, Sinead.
And that's all from Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.